Thanks for tuning in for the February 11th podcast. I'm Stacey Clardy, section editor of the Neurology Podcast and the Neurology Minute. This week's featured interview is about visual snow syndrome. In the What's Trending segment, you'll hear an interview on the allegations related to multiple sclerosis drug kickbacks. Remember, we offer free CME for each eligible podcast. Just find the Neurology Podcast episode online and click on the CME quiz link. You can get up to 60 hours of CME for past shows, all available online on the same webpage. It's free for AAN members.
Hi, everyone. This is Tisha May Monteith from the University of Miami with the Neurology Podcast. Today, we will be discussing a recent paper published in Neurology called The Visual Snow Syndrome, a clinical and phenotypical description of 1,100 cases. I have the pleasure of discussing this paper with the first author, Francesca Puleta, a neurologist from Italy whose research interest is on visual snow and is currently completing a PhD in neuroscience at King's College London. Visual snow is defined by dynamic and continuous dots across the entire visual field, somewhat like television static, and was recently added to the appendix of the third edition of the International Classification of Headache Disorders, so it's still under research investigation. Francesca, thank you for being here with us today. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
So tell us about your paper. Can you briefly explain, first of all, the study design and the population characteristics?
Yes, of course. The study essentially had a web-based questionnaire design so that people with visual snow could participate from anywhere in the world. And it was advertised on public forums that are visited by people with a condition who then essentially reached out to our study group asking to be involved in research. We developed the questionnaire in collaboration with a patient group and essentially following the clinical criteria that have been published a few years ago for the visual snow syndrome and that define it. And based on the answers to this questionnaire, we were then able to characterize and group our main population as patients who have the full-blown visual snow syndrome, which is characterized by this main symptom that is the visual static and is described as tiny flickering dots, sometimes as a TV static, like you were saying. But they also have several other additional symptoms like palynopsia, entoptic phenomena, sensitivity to light, and difficulty seeing at night. And then there was a much smaller group of subjects who had a, so to speak, more simple presentation with just the main symptom of the static and perhaps either none or a few additional visual symptoms. And these subjects didn't fulfill the entire criteria for the syndrome, but they were still analyzed and described in detail in the paper.
Do they look like the typical migraine patient in terms of demographics? And how often did they have migraine?
The demographics of visual snow is quite similar to that of migraine with regards to age. They are quite a young population. We found that the onset is actually perhaps even younger than that of migraineurs typically. And actually, a lot of people reported having visual snow for as long as they could remember. One big difference with migraine and the typical migraine population is that we found quite an equal gender distribution in our cohort. It wasn't more prevalent in the female population.
That's interesting. And so how did the features of visual snow compare to subjects that were exposed to recreational drugs?
Yes. So in the study, we were particularly strict with previous exposure to recreational drugs because we wanted to avoid any possible effect of psychedelics on the visual system and also to avoid confusion with conditions like hallucinogen persisting perception disorder. So we excluded from our visual snow and visual snow syndrome groups anyone who had been exposed to recreational drugs for at least a year prior to the onset of symptoms. And this, first of all, allowed to confirm that visual snow is not caused by the use of recreational substances. But at the same time, it allowed to compare patients with suspected possible HPPD that still presented with symptoms of visual snow to our typical visual snow syndrome cases. And so we did find some differences. For example, HPPD subjects were most commonly male. They had usually a later onset of symptoms, and the start of the symptomatology was a bit more abrupt. But actually, when it came to the main clinical features, they didn't particularly differ from the typical visual snow syndrome. So the static and the associated visual symptoms that I was talking about were essentially quite similar with regards to both the presentation and frequency. And this we think is quite interesting because it tells us that these conditions are, yes, different disorders, but they possibly do share some common pathophysiological background. And it might even give some insight into why psychedelics cause visual symptoms in some people and not in others, which is something that I think researchers have been wondering for a while.
And so you found a really unique way to like go on the internet and really interact with patients and get patient perspectives, which I think is really interesting. How would you say that from all the research you've done, how the criteria fits that's already been proposed with the cases that you've seen?
Yeah, so we found that the diagnostic criteria actually fit the description of the syndrome very well in most subjects. In fact, we only had a small minority of people who completed the questionnaire and then ended up not actually having a diagnosis of visual snow in our follow-up. And of course, these subjects were then excluded from further study. And by following the criteria, we found that the main clinical findings, we found some details about them. For example, the static, which, as I said, is the overarching symptom in visual snow. We found it to be most commonly described as black and white, although it can also be transparent, colored, or flashing, and it can actually even present with more than one type in the same person. And we also found that with regards to the associated visual symptoms, the most common ones that are almost invariably reported by patients are floaters, after images, which is a form of palinopsia, and photophobia. And we also confirmed that the static is constant. And this was really important because it's what constitutes a key difference between visual snow and migraine aura. In fact, we know that visual aura, even if it's prolonged, by definition, it's a transient neurological phenomenon, whereas the snow, it of course may be less visible in certain conditions, but essentially it's always there. And another major difference with visual aura is that the static in visual snow occupies the entire visual field and is not only in one part of it.
Interesting. You also mentioned that it might be best to call or at least describe visual snow as a disorder on a spectrum.
Yes. So one of the questions we had at the start of the study was if there are in visual snow syndrome specific subgroups or clinical endophenotypes. So we wanted to understand if we could identify different types of presentations in different patients within the syndrome. So we did something called a latent class analysis that allows to look at this question specifically. And we actually found that, on the contrary, visual snow doesn't present with endophenotypes, and rather it presents more of a spectrum type disorder like many other neurological conditions. So there's a spectrum of severity where on one end you'll have people who have some very mild static, none of the associated visual symptoms, and possibly in some cases don't even know that there's anything different in their vision. And I've personally encountered these people even in my groups of friends and colleagues. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you'll have people who have all or almost all of the 8 associated symptoms, and they're completely debilitated by visual snow. And what we found actually was that these subjects are also the ones that tend to most commonly also have migraine and tinnitus. So these are not only the most frequent comorbidities of visual snow, but they're also what defines the more severe cases of the syndrome.
Interesting. I've seen 2 patients with what I thought was visual snow syndrome. And then when I sent them to ophthalmology, one had CMV retinitis and another had some type of retinopathy. And so where do you think on the nervous system this problem lies?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think there are certainly some cases of ophthalmological disorders, of extremely severe cases that can present with features of visual snow. And so I think it's really important to keep in mind, as you did when we encounter a patient who we think has visual snow, to exclude any possible secondary causes. But in general, I think these are most likely exceptions, these clinical presentations. I think from all of the features of the syndrome, the fact that it's a panfield disorder, the fact that it's associated to all of these visual symptoms like palinopsia and photophobia, I think most likely we're looking at a central nervous system dysfunction, possibly of the associative visual cortex or of complex brain networks. But we're still trying to understand that.
And what advice do you have for the practicing general neurologists that might come across these types of patients?
As advice to my colleagues, I would say to just keep in mind that visual snow is a highly unrecognized condition. So I think that for affected patients, even just having the correct diagnosis and acknowledgement of their problem is a huge step forward. So if possible, always think about visual snow when patients present with positive visual phenomena. And as we were saying before, when you do encounter someone who you think has visual snow, always exclude secondary causes and also evaluate treatable comorbidities. And finally, I think it's also important to reassure patients that from what we've seen and what we know, this condition is not degenerative. It will not make them blind, and most likely they will with time develop some form of tolerance to it.
I'm very excited about your work. Can you tell us about some of your next steps in research without giving too much away?
No spoilers. But I think the most important thing in this field of research is really to understand the basic biology of visual snow. And I think that's the only way we'll be able to offer more valuable treatment options in the future.
Excellent. Well, you've just been listening to another neurology podcast. Take care.
Hey, this is Jason Crowell from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. And for our What's Trending segment today, I'm excited to have Ed Silverman join us on the podcast. Ed is a senior writer with Stat News and runs the Pharmalot blog that covers the drug industry. Today, we're going to discuss a recent article published in Stat News titled Patient Charity Settles Allegations It Helped MS Drug Makers Pay Kickbacks. It was published on November 20th by Elizabeth Cooney, a colleague of Ed's and an editor for Stat Plus. Ed, thanks for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So obviously, we continue our ongoing conversation today on drugs and the cost of drugs. If you'd like a refresher on some of the drug pricing podcasts we've done in recent months, check out our delayed recall episode from October 2019, where you'll find some good information on the drug pricing issue. So Ed, this story involving kickbacks between drug companies and patient assistance programs is an important one for clinicians to understand. And call me naive, but before I saw this story, I don't think I even knew this was a thing that happened. And so before we get into the specifics of this story, can you help me and our listeners understand how or why a patient assistance group would want to conspire with drug companies? And what are the underlying motivations here?
So it's a complicated behind-the-scenes relationship. The ultimate goal in setting up these assistance programs or charity programs is for the pharmaceutical company to sell more medicine and the charity's fee or some sort of remuneration for their trouble. The drug companies are in this unusual position where they know that the prices for their medicines, as they increase, are more difficult for some patients to pay for. It's a basic affordability issue. So the drug companies have established two methods, generally speaking, to help patients with that problem. One is a direct program that attempts to help patients directly by providing free medicine. In other instances, though, the drug company will work with what's loosely called the patient charity to set up a mechanism by which the patient can receive assistance in order to obtain the medicine. And so there are effectively two different animals there. The issue of the last couple of years that's attracted attention from the federal government and others, lawmakers, has to do with these patient charities. And the concern is that the drug companies are somehow using the charities to induce patients to obtain medicines that they may not otherwise purchase. For example, if you're drug company A and you have a medication for multiple sclerosis, they're likely going to be competitive medicines. So maybe you work a relationship with a patient charity and you agree to provide the assistance so that the charity can work with the patient and lower the patient's copay, which is the whole goal, is to help the patient afford the medication. But how does that really help the drug company? The feds, as I call them, have discovered in many cases, many instances, that drug company A worked with a patient charity to fund a program to favor its own medicine. So as a result, it's sort of like stacking the deck. And the government's concerned that it's really an inducement that is illegal. An underlying concern that the federal government has to do with kickbacks. There's a federal law known as the Anti-Kickback Statute, and this prohibits drug companies from offering or paying, either directly or indirectly, any sort of remuneration, which could include money or something else of value, but let's call it money or a copayment, to induce someone who's on Medicare or another federal health care program to purchase their drugs. And this is where the Department of Justice has entered the picture, because the Justice Department has alleged that some of these patient charities have made it possible for the drug companies to evade the law. And they've actually pursued I've lost track, 9 or 10 companies, including some very large ones, over the past nearly 2 years, and reached settlements because they found that the companies were violating that anti-kickback law that I just mentioned.
Yeah, so it's not a problem that they're trying to help patients get the drugs. It's that they're trying to persuade these groups to push patients towards their specific drugs.
Yes, I mean, the notion of a drug company trying to help patients who can't afford a medicine get that medication that they would not otherwise be able to afford is a lofty goal. The issue here, the problem here, has been the way some of these companies have gone about doing that. And there's been some criticism of these charities going back quite a while. For one thing, I mentioned the idea, at least on the surface, that it's a lofty goal. But some folks say that these charities, or the use of these charities, really amounts to a public relations campaign that does attract a patient to an expensive medicine. A study had come out a few months ago that was very interesting, and it found that nearly all of the programs run by the 6 largest charities failed to provide assistance to people without insurance and were also more likely to cover or make it possible for patients to obtain expensive brand name medicines rather than generics. So on the surface, it sounds like a lofty goal. Patients who can't otherwise afford a medicine are able to do so. But when you dig a little deeper, you find that there's a much more selective process underway. And that benefits the brand name drug company, because if the patient charity is inclined or can be convinced to set up a fund to help the patients with their copays, but that fund only will cover Company A's drug, but not Company B's drug or a generic drug, well, Company A is getting the business, it's getting the revenue, because the patient is essentially being steered toward its drug. Because competitive drugs, there may not be assistance provided by that patient charity, I should say.
We would expect patients with or without insurance to be helped all the same, right? But it sounds like that's not the case.
Right, right. I could read you the, I think, very interesting bottom line finding from that study. It was published in JAMA back in August. It found that of 274 different disease-specific programs run by charities in 2018, so this is recent, 97% required insurance coverage for eligibility. Meanwhile, the brand name drugs that cost more than $10,000 for each Medicare beneficiary in 2016 were 3 times more frequently covered by charities than generics. So according to this study, it's obviously skewed in favor of brand name drug makers. And it stands to reason that a brand name drug company is going to push a medicine that has a large margin, you know, large volume. I mean, this is business, but the issue here is it being done in a way that doesn't break the law and provides patients with what they should be getting? And the feds have found too often the answer to those two questions has been no.
That's very interesting, and I think it's very helpful in explaining what's happening underneath the surface. Pertaining to this story specifically that was published on your site in November dealing with MS drug makers, what drugs and drug companies were involved here, and what was the allegation?
Okay, there were 3 companies, Teva Pharmaceutical, Biogen, and Novartis, each of which sells multiple sclerosis drugs, although Teva has trailed more recently because their medication, Copaxone, has faced generic competition. But in any event, the feds contended that these 3 companies work with a particular charity in favoring their own medicines. The charity funneled money donated by the 3 drug makers to MS patients to ensure that patients took the drugs from those 3 companies and not competitive medications, regardless of price.
That's very interesting. One thing that maybe you could help me understand a little bit better is you mentioned earlier this anti-kickback statute that prevents drug companies from incentivizing patients to buy their drug. But how is that different than when drug companies have their own patient assistance programs to help patients get their drug? What's the difference in those two situations?
Well, the anti-kickback statute pertains to Medicare patients, patients who are enrolled in a government healthcare program, and you're not allowed to provide an inducement to those patients, those beneficiaries, to take your medicine. That's why you have these charities. They're set up to try and help people in ways that allow patients to get medication they may not otherwise be able to obtain.
I'm not sure I fully grasped it here. You know, if a drug maker helps patients afford the copay for their own drug, how is that allowed? But if they give the money to a charity group who who then gives it to patients to afford their copay that's not. Does that make sense?
I'll try my best to articulate this and hopefully it can be usable. The big distinction, as I started to say, has to do with the Medicare patients. If it's a program run by a drug company and your private insurance, your employer insurance doesn't cover enough of it or doesn't cover that drug, but you still need it, there's no alternative, other drugs didn't work, and you can't afford the drug, you could apply to the drug company for whatever program they have. Generally, it would be providing some amount of the drug for free or low cost. The difference here is that the feds are looking at Medicare patients, and they're finding that the charities and the companies are working, and this is my word, not theirs, but to pervert the system used to provide financial assistance to pay for the copays so that the patient can get the drug. The problem here is that the way that the charities and the drug companies are working together is to favor one drug or one company's drug at the expense of others. So as the feds see it, the playing field is not level. And as a result, it's the equivalent of an inducement, which then is interpreted to violate the kickback law. Last month, two lawmakers, Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, was in Rhode Island. They asked the Department of Health and Human Services to update its oversight and require more disclosure from these charities. And they didn't uncover this themselves, but the lawmakers pointed out that essentially the drug makers are gaming the system because not only are they boosting sales of the medicines, but they're donating medicines to the charities and getting tax breaks.
Kind of double dipping in that sense.
Yeah.
I understand. That's helpful. That makes sense. Ed, would you say that there's anything we as clinicians should be doing differently in our practice or when we talk to patients about the drugs that we're prescribing, specifically the high-cost drugs whose makers might be involved in practices like this?
Tough question to answer because we all know that clinicians have less and less time to spend with each patient, and there's more and more paperwork associated with insurance coverage. Prior authorization is a big issue, of course. So whenever possible, I would urge clinicians, given that we're talking about diseases where the price tag for the medicines are costly and getting more expensive, and it's not just new ones, the price of older MS drugs have been rising over the years, as we all know, I would urge them to sit down and say, okay, let's talk about the cost. Take 2 minutes, or make sure you have someone in your office before that patient leaves to sit down and say, okay, let's make sure your insurance covers this. And if they don't, let's figure out some options. But I would actually suggest they go the extra step and make sure that person on the staff is educated and trained so that they can look into what other options exist. If the insurance doesn't cover it, or if they're on Medicare and they have problems with their copay, can that person find an alternative means of paying for the copay so that they can get the medicine? And that might mean looking at patient charities, becoming familiar. I understand there's an investment of time here and nothing is static, but once you make that initial effort, I would imagine it's like any other scenario where you learn something and going forward, you're able to work off a knowledge base that allows you to recognize what works and what doesn't, what's new and needs to be looked at twice when you're talking to the next patient. That, again, takes a little bit of effort, but I think that it's an important basic step. And you think of it, if you're a clinician and you're running a practice or you're a partner in a practice, you're providing your customer with an additional service that they'll appreciate. Because if you don't do that, you got to figure your office is only going to get tagged with more time later when your patients call back and say, I can't afford the medicine. What do I do? So if you arm yourself and make that effort now, you'll be better off later. And I mean, to a certain degree, this is common sense, right? But it reflects the ever-changing nature of practicing medicine. And like it or not, it's probably something if folks aren't doing it. And I imagine a lot of clinicians are already doing this. Certainly, they understand it. It's not rocket science. It takes that extra effort.
Yeah, thanks. I think that's a great suggestion. The phrase that we've been using here on the podcast that's increasingly common in the literature is a drug's financial toxicity. So what is its risk for inducing financial toxicity? Just like we would talk with patients about a drug's effectiveness or its tolerability or other side effects, we should also assess its financial toxicity or its risk for that before we prescribe it.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's true.
Ed, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about this. I encourage our listeners to read the article. Again, it's titled Patient Charity Settles Allegations. It helped MS drug makers pay kickbacks. It was published in Stat News on November 20th by Ed's colleague Elizabeth Cooney. Ed, thanks again for your time today.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
This is Stacey Clardy. Please check out this week's journal. There's a great article on accelerated epigenetic age and cognitive decline among urban-dwelling adults, and another article on incidence and risk factors in patients with inflammatory neuropathy. As always, thank you for listening. Until next week. The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.